RCR is on a mission to revive honest media. It's a good mission, and now you can be an integral part of it by joining the RCR Foundation Members Club. Receive exclusive benefits only available to club members, including discounted merch, your backstage pass to join the host for interactive behind-the-scenes discussions, and the popular daily curated news summary, RCR Bites, delivered to your email inbox every weekday morning, keeping you on the pulse of the news that matters in just a few minutes per day. To find out more, check out www.realitycheck.radio/members or click the FMC button on the bottom right of your RCR app. This is the Fourth Estate on RCR Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Fourth Estate here on Reality Check Radio on Friday the 31st of May 2024. I'm your host this morning for the first time, Marty Gibson, stepping in to take some of the pressure off our usual hosts, Marie Buskey and Alistair Harding. And on today's show, we'll be looking at the continued decline of the mainstream media. Whether it will indeed create news deserts. We'll look at the media awards, the recent media awards, and the slightly monocultural flavour of documentaries currently airing on our state broadcaster, TVNZ. We'll take a look at the fresh injection of funding the Christchurch Call Foundation is to receive from Melinda Gates. And finally, we'll have a look at the Select Committee recommendations on the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill. Now, here to take us through all of this, the learned gentleman, Marie, assures me, makes the whole thing easy. David Harvey, former judge and mastermind winner and blogger with a speciality in internet and media law. How are you this afternoon, David?
Thanks, buddy. Fine. Very good. All well. Thanks for the introduction.
Also here, Peter Williams, former broadcaster and current RCR host, a regular fixture on television screens from the late 70s to 2018. He consistently featured as one of New Zealand broadcasting's most engaging personalities. Peter, how are you?
Hello, Marty. I don't know what that's supposed to mean. It certainly wouldn't be the case now, I don't think. But however, time has moved on and other thinking has been left behind.
Well, that's healthy. So welcome. First up, let's take a look at whether we are in danger of news deserts, which is an article on the One News website at the moment, and which says, in mere months, more than a dozen community newspaper titles have merged, sold, or shuttered in a wave of consolidation as leading researchers raise concerns about the emergence of news deserts. It comes amid wider turmoil in the media sector as hundreds of journalists lose their jobs due to the closure of News Hub and TVNZ's cuts to current affairs programming. Cuts this year have been blamed on falling advertising revenue and a tough economy. Is there really going to be a news desert, or is citizen journalism going to be like CO2, do you think? Greening the deserts, even though it's demonised by the establishment.
Oh, Marty, I don't think there's any danger of the supply of news drying up, as you would say, to continue the analogy of a news desert. The fact that a few community publications have closed down is a sign, I think, more of the local economy. Certainly where I am in central Otago, I get two weekly publications. One is the Upper Clutha Messenger, and the other is the Cromwell Bulletin. They're both printed on glossy paper, full of what we used to call the classified ads. Extraordinarily, in these so-called tough economic times, each of them has a couple of pages of employment ads. So there are jobs around where I live. So the fact that both of these publications, which to be fair don't contain much in the way of news, of local news, they're more advertising bulletins or advertising bulletin boards, I suppose you would say, of the old style, it doesn't give you an indication that there's a problem with local media in this part of the world anyway. Now, you talk about the merging or the non-publication of a lot of those community newspapers. I don't know what parts of the country you're referring to, but I suspect that they'll be more a reflection of the local economy more than anything else. I mean, where I live, and I come back to the Central Otago Southern Lakes area, which is, as we heard in the census recently, one of the fastest growing regions in the country. We have local publications coming out our ears down here. There's the Wanaka Sun, there's the Mountain Scene, there's the what's called the News. A lot of them are published by the big guys, admittedly, Allied Press out of Dunedin, or by Stuff. But there is plenty of community publication going on in Central Otago. But that's because the economy here is strong compared, I suspect, to other parts of the country. And it's really a reflection of the local economy more than anything else, I think.
David, have you seen any deserts where you live?
Well, there's been a desert for a while, Marty, because what used to be the sort of the community leaders, the Western leader and the Central leader and so on and so forth, have been in some difficulty for a number of years. And one of the problems that sort of seemed to hasten the demise was the fact that there was no delivery service. So there was no way of getting the particular publication into the letterbox. I don't think I've seen one of those sort of local or community type of newspapers in my letterbox for a long, long time. But that doesn't mean that they're not there. It just means that distribution has got a problem. And I think in many respects, what is happening is that much of the local news, if you like, or local information, is migrating online. Mm. And that's not anything that should surprise anybody, given that the internet is a much more efficient means of communication than somebody randomly dropping something in your letterbox from time to time. But the other thing that is interesting about local newspapers is the way that they're being gobbled up by the majors. And certainly there was a report that I read, I think it was some local newspapers in the Hawke's Bay area, something of that nature, was being gobbled up by Stuff. And what is happening, of course, is that local news or news publication and the mechanics of getting it out are being centralized into the sort of mega organizations. Now, you know, these are people who are complaining about the threat that is coming down the line from Facebook and Google and so on and so forth in terms of revenue, and yet they are making themselves large monolithic organizations by swallowing up smaller publications and then using the economies of scale to distribute them. But I entirely agree with Peter's point of view that the general malaise, if you like, that it's affecting local publications has a lot to do with the local economy and what difficulties it might be facing.
Yes, certainly. We advertise through, my wife and I have a business, and we advertise in papers. We find it effective, but it's effective because our customers tend to be a bit older. I had the great privilege to work as a journalist at the Gisborne Herald for about 6 years, from about 2006, and I absolutely loved it. And I say it was a privilege because I managed to work as a journalist on the basis of a few columns that I wrote that didn't have spelling or grammatical errors. So it generated a little bit of resentment from the 20-something ladies who'd been through 7 years of university and then internships to get the job. But as far as I can tell, a few things happened after I left. They went very woke and stopped, or at least severely choked, contrarian views, particularly on climate change, COVID, Maori ethno-nationalism, and autogynephilia. And this was at least partly because they were taking government money in both direct subsidies and full rack price ads. So it's probably a bit of bounce back from that. And they also, as you're describing, tried to move to a digital subscription model, still keeping linear news. And at one point I met with the managing director and floated the idea of making the paper more like Wikipedia for the East Coast, where each subject had its own silo of news and information and then was informed by figures. And I think there's probably room to develop really interesting media like that in terms of something that updates automatically where there's more discussion and that's synthesized into perhaps a centralized view of, well, what are the major problems that we've got and how do we solve them?
Yeah, I think also, guys, it comes down to economy of scale. I'm thinking down here, yes, Allied Press, publishers of the Otago Daily Times, they publish now the Wanaka Sun. They bought that a couple of years ago. They own Mountain Scene, which was always a fiercely and quite famous independent newspaper in Queenstown. Stuff, I think, owns The News, which is Alexandra-based, central Otago-based. So the big guys, you might say, have swallowed up those sorts of publications. There's also a couple of fledgling websites down in this part of the world trying to make a go of it. One is called the Wanaka app. The other's called the Central Otago app. They're owned by the same guys, and they just rely on subscriptions. They have a little bit of advertising. And then there's an outfit based in Queenstown called Crux, which has some fantastic local journalism. But those places are really, really battling because they can't attract basically linear advertising, and they've pretty much got their hand out in a begging bowl kind of situation looking for subscriptions. So this is becoming more and more the model, not just in local media, but in mainstream big-time media as well, and certainly for startups like us, for startups like The Platform. But you see, Stuff have still got their begging bowl out pretty much every day, haven't they, asking for donors. You've got The Herald, which is looking for its premium subscriptions. So it's more and more becoming a user pays, which, of course, is the way in the old days we always used to get our news, didn't we? We always paid a subscription for a newspaper delivery or paid for a one-off daily purchase of a paper. So in many respects, it's nothing new, this idea of asking for people to pay for their news. It's just that in the very early days of the internet, I'm thinking back 30 years ago in the mid-1990s, the big publishing companies made what I thought was an absolutely fatal mistake, and I thought this at the time, a fatal mistake by giving stuff away for nothing. That was back 95, 96, and look at the strife they got themselves into. If they had started charging for their internet news right from the off, they might not be in the trouble they're in today. We might have become used to paying for our news on the internet back in those days, the way that we'd always paid for it, through buying something at the newsstand or at the dairy.
It's perverse, isn't it? It's a bit like when people get used to free healthcare. They don't look after their health as well as if they had to pay for it. And it's I think, very similar for that other most important freedom, that important aspect of life, which is freedom. You take it for granted if you don't pay for it. And if you're not paying for it, then often you're the product.
Yeah.
Well, one of the early mantras on the internet, I don't know if it was John Perry Barlow or somebody like it, coined the phrase, information wants to be free, as if information had a choice. But it reflected the ethos, if you like, of this wonderful network where people could gain all sorts of knowledge and understanding and wisdom and so on and so forth, through a quick search and getting hold of an article or something like that, which in the original model of the internet was the way that it was designed. It was designed as an information sharing utility that was used mainly by academics. And that sort of information wants to be free ethos spread out. And it was quite fascinating to see the amount of stuff that was free. And I agree, Peter, it was a catastrophic mistake that they didn't immediately adopt the subscription model. But it was difficult, I think, for news media to adapt to the new paradigm. And I think in many respects, they're still having difficulty adapting to the new paradigm. But maybe we'll talk some more about that later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, it is an institutional thing. And I guess, speaking of institutional things, we've had the Voyager Media Awards last Friday, which very much was the media industry celebrating itself. Now, Peter, you've been doing some of the finest, most principled work of your career in recent years. How did you get on?
Didn't enter, actually, Marty. Oh. Didn't know they were on. Was never sent an entry form. To be honest, I find media awards a complete and utter waste of time. I've looked at them with a good deal of disdain for most of my working life. I just don't see much point in them, apart from the ability of the bosses to use in marketing campaigns. If you win an award, I can tell you for a fact it does absolutely nothing for your future career prospects. I had the good fortune twice to be voted by readers of, what's it called, TV Week or the TV Weekly or something. Twice they voted me the best newsreader, whatever the hell that means. Now, that was actually a bit of viewer appreciation, or rather reader appreciation. But did it make any difference in terms of my pay, in terms of my career prospects? Absolutely nothing. Absolutely not. So I just don't think they matter a heck of a lot. There's a lot of, back slapping and congratulations and that sort of thing inside the industry. But outside the industry, I just don't think people care. And that's frankly the way it should be. And I ask the question, is there an industry which celebrates itself more than the media industry? Because as well as those Voyager Awards, you've also got the Film and Television Awards, you've got the Radio Awards. It just doesn't matter. And there are so many of them now. Once upon a time, it was just sort of best journalist, best young journalist, reporter of the year kind of thing. But somehow it's morphed into, 60, 70 awards per night. And as a consequence, the more awards you have, the more they get devalued. But it's just another excuse, like I say, for the bosses to use in marketing campaigns. So I don't pay too much attention to them. One of the better things I saw, though, in the sort of aftermatch wash-up from last Friday night was about the political journalist of the year, where I think Jack Tane got some kudos, basically for the interviews he does on a Sunday morning on Q&A. Somebody said on my X feed, on my Twitter feed, Thomas Cranmer should have been the one who was the political journalist of the year. That's Philip Crump, the lawyer, who has frankly broken and reported far more political stories than the rest of the industry put together. Yet, even though he's been picked up by News Talk ZB, I don't know how that relationship is going, but he's very prominent now on Twitter with some great exposés of MPs' expenses. He was the one who blew the whistle on the Nanaia Mahuta nepotism. He is leading the way, yet was he considered for an award? No. Should he have been? Absolutely yes. So that just goes to show that I just don't think these awards are particularly prestigious or valuable or meaningful.
Yeah, that disconnect and people being that conspicuous by their absence is another example, it seems, of similar to government COVID inquiries and the police complaints authority of people, where people get to mark their own homework. And it's not always representative of reality. Speaking of people marking their own homework, there have been some curious programming decisions by our state-owned broadcaster lately. The plethora of documentaries being re-aired that all have a similar flavour. I watched Web of Chaos when it aired again recently with my mouth open, I have to say. It was airing about a year and a half after it first aired, and it really hadn't aged well. Graham Adams, another citizen journalist essentially, wrote about the proliferation and funding of such documentaries in a column this week. I think it was published on Tuesday, saying documentaries made with funding from the previous government were focused on, I quote, exposing disinformation allegedly put out by the far right, which he says is looking like becoming a genre of its own. Exposing the disinformation disseminated by the far left and by the state itself, as the Twitter files revealed, doesn't seem to hold a similar appeal for our filmmakers and commissars. In fact, you might conclude the left generally is blameless, despite even its run-of-the-mill activists being dedicated to promoting radical transgender ideology, extravagant climate change scenarios, selective state censorship, and anti-democratic Maori nationalism. A cynic might think the far right includes anything to the right of Te Pāti Māori or the Greens. Now, Peter, with you have one of the broadest arcs of institutional memory in New Zealand broadcasting. What do you make of what seems to be this jammed rudder in terms of TVNZ broadcasting those documentaries, which were made thanks to the largesse of the Podium of Truth?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? Ever since Sunday finished, when was it, 2-3 weeks ago, that 7:30 slot on a Sunday has been replaced with these documentaries, which are not recent publications. And a very fair question was asked the other day, if they're showing Web of Chaos and the bit about the documentary about what happened in Pukekohe back in the 1950s with, what was it called, No Maoris Allowed, how come River of Freedom hasn't got to go? Which is the movie made about the protests in 2022. Yeah, it's just a complete and utter and quite ludicrous and obvious lack of balance, which I would have thought goes across, right across the Broadcasting Act, old as it may be, but no matter what it's going to be replaced with, if indeed it ever will be replaced or updated, there's still surely got to be the call for balance and impartiality and for both sides of the story to be told, admittedly, over a period of time. But I don't know about you, David, but I'm not seeing much in the way of, shall we say, right-wing thinking coming into any documentaries in that slot at 7:30 on a Sunday night.
Well, you're absolutely right, Peter, and I had a look at the programming that's coming up this Sunday. And believe it or not, they've got the repair shop on, a repair shop special, where I think the repair shop people are getting involved with the king, which will make a pleasant break. But I should be interested to see if there's a pattern that develops as far as the programming is concerned in the future for that Sunday 7:30 slot. What I found interesting was that my wife and I watched the No Maoris Allowed documentary. I was surprised that it dated back to 2022. I was surprised that it was made by the same people who had made Web of Chaos. And all of a sudden, there's too many coincidences that are happening. But what I did find remarkable was a commentary by no less a person than Chris Trotter, who's not known for his right-wing views, who basically said that the major premise of the documentary, which was about shocking racism in Pukekohe and how this should never have happened, was well known. And he said in an article, if the results of historical research can evoke powerful responses for those on the receiving end of past injustices, that is all the more reason to be cautious and respectful in unfolding the historical record. Painting Pukekohe's racism as a dark and dirty secret, which the rest of New Zealand was only too willing to keep under wraps, is a grossly unfair distortion of the truth, which the makers of No Maori Allowed should not have encouraged. The Pukekohe colour bar was known right across New Zealand, not only while it was in operation, but also following its demise in the early 1960s. It was the subject of newspaper articles and sermons, most of which were sharply critical of Pukekohe's Pākehā townsfolk and their market gardening neighbours. This criticism only became more acute as the civil rights movement in both southern states, the USA and South Africa, began to make headlines around the world in the 1950s and 1960s. And he's absolutely right. And as I thought about it, I began to recall my own experiences as far as Pukekohe was concerned, and the fact that it was well known that there was a particular racist approach in that town. And certainly when I was sitting from 1989 onwards, Pukekohe was within our particular circuit. And the reverberations were still happening, even then. And to suggest that this was some deep and dark secret, as Chris Trotter has pointed out, and nobody else knew about it, was rubbish. There was nothing new about it. It was well known. And yet the documentary tried to put it out back a couple of years ago and again in 2024 that this was something new. It wasn't. The person who wrote the book had obviously done a lot of careful research about it, but tried to portray it as something that had been covered up and hidden. It wasn't. It was well known.
The other thing I would say, guys, is that, and I've just been thinking about this also in the context of the ABC in Australia. Any viewers to Sky News here will know that ABC News and ABC Current Affairs is very much looking at life from a left-wing perspective. Yet nothing comes down from on high from the board or from the management of that organisation. It's the same in this country. Just before they left office last year, Willie Jackson stacked the board of TVNZ with a lot of his, what you might call, left-wing lovies, you know, Linda Clark, et cetera, et cetera. The board of New Zealand On Air is pretty much composed of a group of people, most of whom I would imagine have voted Labour or Green or Te Pāti Māori. Yet when the right-wing governments get into power, they don't make any new appointments. They don't make any significant appointments to those organisations. Therefore, the left-leaning thinking can basically feed on itself through governments of all hues. And it's the same in Australia as it is here, that Liberal governments in Australia, National-led governments in this country, do not seem to regard it as a priority to appoint people to the boards of their broadcasting and media organisations who can insist that there should be some, shall we say, programming of a right-leaning hue get onto the media outlets. So in many respects, you can sheet it back to our current political leadership. They should have looked at that TVNZ board, which was stacked only, what, 2 or 3 months out from the last election, and said, I'm sorry, time's up, we're replacing you with some of our people. But there's no sign of that happening, no sign of it happening at the board of New Zealand On Air either. So until the political leadership get in there and make some serious appointments, then I just don't think the left-leaning coverage that we get on our state-owned media organizations or state-owned media agencies is going to change. And therefore, you blame the politicians for it.
Well, the main change has been that it's been getting more shrill, if anything. And we've seen a lot of cartoonish characterization of New Zealand history, particularly around the 1800s, a representation that seems to me, anyway, primarily aimed at getting children and poorly educated or incurious adults to be angry and hate their fellow citizens. And I think we probably need to get a handle on how dangerous that is. It's a very Maoist attempt to rewrite history in many cases. And of course, we've had, as you say, Peter, 2 terms of a Labour-led government busily putting the Mao into Māori at every opportunity.
I like that.
The decision to leave the musket wars out of New Zealand history was one of the most egregious examples, given that it killed 10 times more New Zealanders than the land wars, and as Michael Bassett has said before, was the origin of many of the issues he had to contend with in his various involvements with the Waitangi Tribunal. I mean, is this the misinformation that dare not speak its name?
Could well be. Picking up from what Peter said in the left-wing bias of the media, had an example last night on television, One on News, where we had the interesting scenario where Mikey Sherman was conducting an interview with no less person than Katie Bradford, 2 journalists interviewing one another about budget. But throughout that entire discussion, there was a complete ignorance of any benefits that might accrue from the budget, and basically an opportunity for each of them to say how terribly bad the budget was going to be and how shockingly irresponsible it was, and so on and so on and so on. And I thought, well, you know, here's the Labour finance policy being developed in an interview on Television New Zealand One. An interesting possibility, I suppose, but not unexpected these days. And apart from the fact that it was journalists interviewing journalists, which I always find quite stupid.
And speaking of absolutes as well, weren't they? There's nothing in here for this. And it's,
But there's no balance. That's the problem. An absolute absence of balance, which is so necessary. You've got to have both sides of an argument. That's the way I've done business all of my life, is to consider both sides of the argument. And then as a lawyer to advocate one, or as a judge to decide which is preferable. And you can't do it unless you've got both sides. How's the public of New Zealand to make a decision about whether they think that it's a good thing or a bad thing if they're only getting one side of the argument? It's not an opportunity for both sides of the argument to be heard. I mean, part of the rules of natural justice, it's a Latin phrase, audi alter in partem, hear the other side.
But it's actually written into the legislation. That's the thing that gets me. That Broadcasting Act might be, 35 years old now, 1989, and Melissa Lee said she was going to get around to changing parts of it because it wasn't fit for purpose in the modern era. Well, that may be true, but no matter how it, like I said before, no matter how it's updated, there surely will always be a clause in there that says news information must be reported in a balanced way. Both sides of the story must be told. Yet that particular thinking that, I mean, it's the fundamental aspect, I would have thought, and what I was always taught and always learned, it should be the most fundamental aspect of a media organisation, of a journalism and reporting organisation. Yet nobody seems to care anymore. And we saw that extraordinary thing, not the Web of Chaos, the other one done by Paula Penfold,
Fire and Fury.
Yeah, where they said, it doesn't matter because the other side of the story is wrong, so therefore we're not going to report it. And that was essentially their attitude, which is just an outrageous, arrogant attitude to take. And it's the same regarding climate. No very highly qualified scientist with a thinking about CO2 not affecting the world's climate ever gets any space at all anywhere, because the mantra, according to media organizations, is CO2 is causing climate change and it must be reduced at all costs, and we've got to stop emitting CO2, therefore we've got to subsidize electric cars, blah, blah, blah. We've got to cull our flocks and our herds to stop animals emitting methane, blah, 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 and so it goes on. Yet there are many, many highly qualified scientists who will say, that's bumpkin, but they're never allowed to say. And it seems to me that almost every day, every week, every month, every year, the basic tenet of journalism, of media, is just being abused because only one side of the story is being told. And we've just got politicians who essentially lack courage to tell news executives, media company executives, to pull their head in and follow the law and do what a good Western society should be doing every day of the week. But it's not. And it's just so frustrating, and it's why old people like me just get more and more cynical about this industry, and indeed about this country.
Yeah, I always waver between wondering how much of it's accidental. I mean, the 20-something ladies who had come out of journalism school had normally done a BA and followed up with a 3-year diploma in journalism, and a lot of them, without being unkind, are functionally innumerate. That they're not really numbers people. So there's that accidental bent, and you know, getting through a BA at a modern university, you tend to come out with an attitude to cultural Marxism, that it's a perfectly normal, natural, and righteous way to think. I'm sure that, like me, you and our listeners have found that search engine results now run to pages and pages of orthodoxy, and we've got NewsGuard, various things like that seem a more deliberate effort to control what news we're getting, to make sure it's inside the Overton window and anything outside is memory-holed. And I see Melinda Gates has given Jacinda Ardern's her Christchurch Core Foundation and $20 million to choke it even more in her capacity as patron. And I understand the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet refused to discuss the funding sources for the Christchurch Core Foundation. So there are those other forces coming into play. I've spoken a lot about Mike Benz and the wonderful work he does. I think he's been on RCR 3 times, exposing. He's the executive member of the Foundation for Freedom Online, and he shines a lot of light on the involvement of intelligence agencies and other three-letter agencies in controlling these algorithms and the social media companies using AI since about 2017. And Harvard's very involved in it. That's the umbilicus to the academia, where, of course, Jacinda Ardern's gone. David, in your latest Substack, Dismay and Disappointment, which you published on Tuesday, the 28th, you wrote, although the call as originally conceived was established to tackle terrorist and violent terrorist extremist content online, there has been a degree of mission creep. And you noted that in a briefing paper to Jacinda Ardern in June 2023, it was noted that New Zealand was partnering with US, Microsoft, Twitter, and OpenMind to develop an algorithmic tool that is intended to be used by social media companies, but it did, was mostly LGBT. What have you seen in this space?
Well, that particular information came from no less an authoritative source than the website of the Christchurch Call itself. They made no secret about it. But my particular interest, my concern about the Christchurch Call, and indeed internet regulation generally, is that a communications network can be throttled if there's too much control placed on either the way that it works or the information that is disseminated. I have absolutely no truck at all with information that is designed to inflame people to go out and shoot other people. That's a terrible thing. The law actually covers that type of thing. So when the Christchurch Call was set up to deal with the dissemination of terrorist information and enabling terrorist networks, that in my mind was okay. I was a little bit concerned that a number of sort of civic society groups were getting in behind, like Internet NZ, which was the focus of that particular Substack article. But what proceeded from that was that a large cohort of organizations started getting involved, and very, very gradually a whole lot of things other than terrorism started sneaking into the envelope. And in some respects, this seemed to reflect the left-wing neo-Marxist concerns about organizations like LGBTQ and so on and so forth, and misogyny and all of the rest of it, which has been to associate those who advocate a contrarian position, shall we say. I think that's probably as nice as I can put it, a contrarian position on those particular things, such as people like J.K. Rowling, and automatically they become part of this radicalization of aggression leading to terrorism, leading to violence, that is part of the narrative. So when the Christchurch Call says we're looking at some of these wider things like misogyny and so on and so forth, I'm thinking to myself, you're really drinking the Kool-Aid of this neo-Marxist thinking, and it's unfortunate. Now, as far as the foundation is concerned, great. I'm really pleased to see that it's gone and spun off itself and away from the government. I do not understand that there is any funding that is coming from DPMC. There certainly was. There was up to $500,000 that was being paid for Ardern's travel expenses and so on and so forth. She must have been flying Uber first class for that type of expenditure. I don't believe that any funding is going to the Christchurch Call from the New Zealand government. If Melinda Gates wants to fund it through a private foundation, fine, not a problem. But as far as I'm concerned, the Christchurch Call has gone completely outside of its initial brief. But then, hey, controlling information on the internet, that's nothing new. And look at the way that Monsieur Macron has shut down TikTok in New Caledonia. The French have always been at the forefront of controlling the internet, going as far back as 1912 and the meeting in Deauville following the Arab Spring, when Nicolas Sarkozy wanted to put severe controls on internet content. So, yeah, that's what the Christchurch Call is all about. And although it started with terrorism, which was laudable, it's gone off the campus as far as I'm concerned.
Peter, how paranoid do you allow yourself to get in terms of say, a centrally organized effort to control the information that we're allowed to see?
Well, it's just frustrating. Having visited China a few times, most recently, admittedly, 10 years ago, and finding that once you're inside the borders of the country of China, and you'd know that you just can't access the internet on your mobile phone. So that's frustrating, but I was only there for a couple of weeks, so, you know, I could survive with not worrying about too much what was going on in the world. So if it happens in this country, I would be appalled, frankly, because I believe I'm a purist, really. I believe in freedom of information. I believe in freedom of association. I believe in freedom of expression. And I think any moves made by politicians or by bureaucrats to shut down particular sites is just disgraceful. And that, to me, does not mean that we have an open and free and liberal and democratic society in all those words. So I'm just appalled at any attempt to control the flow of information through the internet. And therefore, I read David's article about Internet NZ, what it was set up to do. It just seems to have gone completely rogue in its attitude towards many things that appear on the internet. It's as if Internet NZ, instead of administering domains, wants to actually control what's on those domains. Yep. And I just think that's appalling.
And of course, we've got the, as well as the social media and search engine companies influenced, you know, by some of those intelligence agencies and other organizations, the other charges that they're taking content from local media outlets and making advertising revenue from that content, then sending most of the profits to countries with more inviting tax rates.
Just one thing before you get on to that particular subject, Marty. The best thing that's happened to the internet in the last year is that Elon Musk has bought Twitter and has said, it's open slather, say what you like, fill your boots, go for your life. Because under its previous ownership, there was obviously a good deal of censorship. Zuckerberg has been bought off. Well, no, he joined the left, probably funds the Democratic Party in the United States. So Facebook is controlling what is going on its feed. But Musk has said, nah, the hell with it. Say what you like. And I think that is the greatest thing that's happened to free speech and freedom of expression in recent times. And frankly, long may it continue.
Well, I mean, again, Mike Benz was interesting on the Mark Zuckerberg had a moment where he said internet censorship has gone too far, opened it up, and then the various people controlling his access to ad revenue basically hit the business with about a $90 billion revenue loss, and he fairly quickly got back in line. So it'll be interesting to see how long Elon Musk continues like that. I hope that it's all as it seems. But the social media companies are seem to be drawing on a diminishing resource in terms of local news, and that was sought to be addressed by the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill that was proposed as a means of addressing this, which was Willie Bat Jackson's baby. And I understand the select committee that was looking at a way of addressing this is favouring scrapping it now because Paul Goldsmith said members were confused by the bill. David, this is very much your wheelhouse, and I understand you took one for the team and read the select committee report. What are your thoughts on it and the issue generally?
I not only read the Select Committee report, I actually made a submission to the Select Committee and appeared before them for I think all of 5 or 10 minutes. But the Select Committee report came out on Tuesday, 28 May. It was a bit of a surprise, although it had been anticipated for some time. What appears to have been the issue was that the report came out anyway despite the fact that Paul Goldsmith, the Minister for Communications, wanted the release of the Select Committee report at least to be deferred, I think, so that they could work out some kind of policy to address some of the problems that it raised. But that didn't happen. And it seems that a couple of National Party members of the Select Committee voted for the release of the Select Committee report. The Select Committee report, first paragraph, says the bill shouldn't go ahead. Very blunt, very, very bold. And, of course, there were a couple of dissents, understandably and unsurprisingly, from the Labour Party members and from the Green Party members. But the starting point is that the bill won't go ahead. Apparently, as far as Goldsmith is concerned, the government is still considering it. But what happened was that the reporting on the particular event went completely over the top and was portrayed as a state of disarray within the government as to what's happening with the Fair Digital News Bargaining Bill. What seemed to me possibly an exercise of individual choice as far as the National Party members of the Select Committee was concerned, it gave rise to a whole lot of speculation that they hadn't got the memo or something had happened, there'd been miscommunication or something of that nature. No, the fact of the matter is that people have been waiting for this report. The report is out there. It recommends the bill doesn't go ahead. But they've had a bob both ways, because what in fact the report does is it contains a draft of the bill with a whole lot of amendments to it. And in the event that Parliament decides that it will go ahead with the bill, these are the amendments that they recommend. And one of the important amendments that didn't appear in the original bill and about which certainly I would have liked to have made submissions was about the use of artificial intelligence as a means of gathering information. Now, the way that AI works and the way that it's sort of cast as far as the bill is concerned are two entirely different creatures. But to expect that politicians would have any understanding of intelligence, let alone artificial intelligence, would probably be a bit of an ask. But the concern about the whole thing is that there is an expectation, and it was published in the spin-off yesterday, where it says, Duncan Greaves says, the most chilling thing to remember is that the news media is currently operating under the assumption that this bill will pass. Were it to be abandoned, it's likely there would be immediate and deep cuts, and it's not inconceivable that another major publisher might quickly go the way of News Hub, which means that if the government were to abandon the bill, it would need to do so with another solution to hand. So that probably is what Minister Goldsmith is considering, another solution, because essentially what the Fair Digital News Bill does is that it sets up a funding arrangement for mainstream media to replace the public interest journalism. That's the way that I see it. It's just another subsidy. And the simple fact of the matter is that without it, news media may be in some difficulty. So they raise the argument that this is a threat to democracy and so on and so forth. No, it's not. It is a demonstration of the fact that they haven't adapted to a new digital paradigm. And it may well be that they should be starting to think about different ways of generating money. Copyright comes to mind. Or alternatively changing their business models. But as Peter said earlier on, part of the problem is that they weren't charging right at the very beginning.
Mm. David, the other thing that I can't figure out, and maybe you can help me here too, Marty, is that when I read news online, when I wake up in the morning, reach for the phone to find out what the time is, I'll quite often flick on to nzherald.co.nz or to Stuff, or I subscribe also to London's Daily Telegraph. So I just have a flick through those news sites. They are domains owned by those companies. I don't get my news through Google or through Facebook. So really, how many people go onto Google to get their news? Don't you go straight to the website of the publishers? And what has that got to do with Google and Facebook and the like lifting material off them? In fact, anytime I see a news story on a Facebook feed or on Twitter or whatever, it's because somebody, like a reader, a consumer, has pushed the button and loaded it up to put on their feed. So I just don't get what the newspaper, what the media organizations are on about here, because people surely get their news direct from the websites, don't they? They don't do it through Google or Facebook. So how much money would actually be raised through these social media behemoths stealing stuff?
Well, in the same way, you see, every morning I get an email from a political scientist named Bryce Eckert, and he collates or curates, I think is the word these days, all of the news stories about various political topics and so on and so forth. And it's fascinating. And if there's something about media that interests me, like, for example, the scoop that I made reference to, I got as a result of Bryce's thing. But what he does, I imagine, is that he scrapes the news sites for their stories. And there are tools, there are digital tools that are available to do this. Now, what Google and up until recently Facebook and various other social media outfits did was that they would use digital tools to scrape the news sites to get the stories and develop a feed in much the same way that Bryce Edwards does. So you've got Google News and Facebook News. Facebook has moved away from news generation. But what the model used to be was that they would put up a list of articles and people would click on them and they would be taken to the New Zealand Herald website. And believe it or not, Peter, most of the Herald's news information, I'm talking around about 2016, 2017, most of the Herald's hits on their website came from Facebook. People would get the feed on their Facebook account, and then they would go and have a look at the story itself. What is interesting there is that ultimately the consumer is going to the news website, the Herald or the Guardian or the Times or whatever. So there are still going to be eyeballs on the advertising on the news website. It's just that Facebook or Google or the social media company is acting as an intermediary in the same way that Bryce Edwards is. And yet what the Fair News digital bargaining bill suggests is that they should be paying a fee for this. Well, there are other justifications for charging a fee without having some kind of statutory impost put in place. But yeah, the short answer is that many people actually do use social media platforms to get their news feed.
It seems to me then, David, the news media companies, Stuff and NZ Herald and One News and the like, it should be the other way around. They should be paying the social media companies for driving eyeballs to their page. It's not as if the social media companies are stealing their stuff. They're really promoting their stuff. So that should be the good news. And if any money is going to change hands, it should go the other way.
Yep. And we should add RCR Bytes to that list of excellent collated news feeds.
Yeah, precisely.
One of the great privileges of being a Foundation Club member.
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I think we're up against time now. Anything to say in closing, reflecting on the week in the Fourth Estate?
I thought budget coverage was about as boring as the topic itself. I don't know why we get so excited about budgets. I really don't. Apparently there's been a few tax cuts as a superannuitant. I'm getting another $4 a week. Whoop-de-whoop-de. I just don't know why news organizations get so excited about budgets, because really not that many people care about them. They have far more important and interesting things in their life to worry about than the budget. It's as if we're being told that the budget is important. It probably is, but for a lot of people, they just can't figure out how or why.
David, you've got some late breaking news.
I've just had a thing from The Guardian, which suggests Donald Trump has been found guilty of using a criminal hush money scheme to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. The verdict came after a jury deliberated for less than 12 hours in an unprecedented first criminal trial against the US president. And that is from The Guardian.
Yep, and it's being reported in this country as well. David, found guilty on all 34 felony counts in the hush money case. I suspect all this means that he's going to win the election in November by an even bigger margin now.
Yep.
Well, that's an interesting thing to close on, I guess. And it opens the door to a whole new part of history, doesn't it?
Oh, well, for sure. For sure. And it'll be interesting to see how the media treat it.
Thank goodness.
Interesting, but not surprising.
Thank goodness, Ed Harvey, you're far more impartial than the man in the New York court.
Well, thanks very much for joining me this afternoon, gentlemen. It's been a great privilege. I hope I haven't said and ah and started too much, but have a great weekend and we'll see you again soon, I hope.
Thank you, Marty.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to, dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.